A change at the Pentagon again today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Department of Defense had an acting secretary, and now he's out. We look at the effect of temporary leadership on the U.S. military. Also, as tensions with Iran escalate, diplomats know it's a dangerous game.
Each side may think that it's a slow-motion process of escalation, but once you begin it, it's not so easy to stop.
Plus, the president wants to deport 1 million undocumented immigrants, but that's easier to tweet than do.
We know we don't have the political will, we don't have the moral will. We certainly don't have the resources to round up 10.5 million people and deport them. I mean, that's laughable.
Those stories, plus the mystery of an ancient bagel dug up by archaeologists, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Iran and the U.S. are not at war. Sometimes it's good to say that out loud to remind ourselves of that, because tensions between Washington and Tehran just keep escalating, statement by statement. Today, a top Revolutionary Guard official said Iran has ballistic missiles capable of hitting carriers at sea, a not-so-thinly veiled reminder to the U.S., which recently deployed an aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf. Part of what the Trump administration says is a concerted effort to send a message to Tehran to back off. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier today.
We are there to deter aggression. President Trump does not want war, and we will continue to communicate that message while doing the things that are necessary to protect American interests in the region.
Meanwhile, Iran says it's just days away from stockpiling enough enriched uranium to exceed the limit set by the 2015 nuclear agreement, the same agreement the U.S. has already abandoned. To find out what this means for the region and the world, we reached out to Dennis Ross. He's a longtime U.S. diplomat who's advised presidents of both parties on Middle East policy.
My worry is that each side at this point thinks that they can keep everything within limits. Trump has come out and said he doesn't want war. The Supreme Leader came out and said there's not going to be a war. Each believes they understand the limits of the other, even at a time when they're not communicating directly. That in itself, I think, creates some risk of miscalculation.
Spin out a scenario for us in terms of miscalculating each other in this standoff.
So let's say that we've just seen again yesterday there were rockets fired by proxy, Shia militia proxies of the Iranians in Iraq that hit a base in Iraq where American forces are also present. Let's say, again, it's not the Iranians doing it directly, but they do everything indirectly or through in a way that they present as being deniable. But let's say they hit a base. One of the Shia militia's rockets hits a base and American forces, God forbid, are killed. Now, the administration then decides, okay, we're going to have to send a message back there. So we decide to go ahead and we decide to hit one of the training facilities for the Shia proxy forces that exist within Iran. What do the Iranians do then? Do the Iranians say, okay, they did it in a way that was designed to maybe limit our casualties, but they impose something. They have to see that there's a price for that. So maybe they do something with a small boat. One of the Revolutionary Guards' small boats that is designed, again, not to hit us, but maybe to do something a little bit more brazen against the ship. And what do we then do? Do we respond to that? Or maybe we have drones up and they've tried to shoot down drones. They shoot down an American drone. Do we then take out the small boat that was responsible for doing that? This is a tit-for-tat relationship where you can see things escalating. Each side may think that it's a slow-motion process of escalation, but once you begin it, it's not so easy to stop.
Are you confident that there is a single and unified policy toward Iran in the Trump administration?
No, I'm not. I mean, even today, we've had the Secretary of State pointing the finger at the Iranians, saying this is a challenge to the international community, saying this is a threat to international shipping. And today we had the president say these were minor incidents. So there's an inconsistency in terms of the messaging. The danger of sending mixed messages that way is that the Iranians may misread it and they may feel, fine, these are minor incidents. Maybe we can do a little bit more. But maybe what they do actually crosses a threshold quite apart from what the president may intend.
What is the way out of this current impasse with Iran?
Well, I do think the way out is start by internationalizing this. Because a threat to international shipping is an international problem. It's not solely an American problem. and recognize that there probably has to be a way to get back into discussions between us and the Iranians. Now, I would say, knowing where the Iranians are right now, a direct discussion with us will look too much like they gave in. My guess is if we're going to see a negotiation, it's probably going to start through a third party. The Japanese were not the right one from the Iranian standpoint. The Russians might be.
The Russians? Really?
Yes. Look, if you think about it, you can see Vladimir Putin presenting himself as an arbiter. He very much likes to be seen as the arbiter in the region. Here's a case where the Iranians would be inclined to trust him. Not a lot, but they would trust him more than anybody else being a go-between. And they probably also see that this is something that President Trump would respond to.
But would you, as a diplomat, trust Vladimir Putin to be the intermediary?
He wouldn't be my choice. I would much prefer to see the French, ironically, even the Chinese, because the Chinese have a stake in avoiding any real escalation. You know, from a Russian standpoint, they don't mind having things heat up first and then coming in to rescue the situation. Having things heat up first could increase and inflate the price of oil. That's in the Russian interest. That's not in the Chinese interest.
Longtime U.S. diplomat Ambassador Dennis Ross. He's advised presidents of both parties on Middle East policy. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
We'll have more on the tensions with Iran, the nuclear deal, and how all this affects Iranians later in the show. First, some news today that will definitely impact U.S. military plans in the region or anywhere. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan is withdrawing as a nominee for the permanent job. And that leaves the Pentagon without a permanent leader at a potentially crucial time. Reva Gujon is the Vice President of Global Analysis at Stratfor. She joins us from Austin, Texas. Reva, what can you tell us about Mark Esper, the now acting Secretary of Defense?
Well, he has a very lengthy civilian and military career. He served in the first Gulf War. He shifted to the civilian side at the Pentagon. He worked on the Hill at the Heritage Foundation think tank. He was a lobbyist for Raytheon. That last bit is probably going to get the biggest scrutiny from Senate, but I don't think he's going to face that many barriers from the Senate. He largely looks uncontroversial in that he hasn't taken many strong policy positions. His focus is really on army reform. And, you know, uncontroversial never sounded so good, arguably.
And do you expect him to simply stay as acting, or do you think he's a prospect to be a permanent Secretary of Defense?
I think it's too early to tell at this point. It's no secret that Trump prefers keeping his nominees in this acting capacity to test them out. But, you know, he's familiar with Mark Esper, and so he may advance to an official nomination.
With all these people in acting titles as opposed to permanent, what does that kind of instability in leadership do to the Department of Defense and U.S. foreign policy in general?
Well, of course, you know, it raises some questions on stability, but overall, I don't think you're going to see much of a policy shift. You know, the military as an institution has been able to proceed as business as usual on a number of different fronts. But right now, we're facing a number of converging crises. And at the forefront, of course, is Iran. We've seen two tanker attacks within a month of each other. And the president not wanting to get into a military conflict could embolden Iran to push harder and still create more triggers for a military confrontation, in which case there's going to be a lot of focus on the Secretary of Defense, either acting or permanent, on whether we will see continued U.S. restraint, a limited strike scenario, or something much bigger.
What do you think Patrick Shanahan's legacy will be?
I think he was the non-confrontational Secretary of Defense, certainly relative to Jim Mattis. That was where a lot of concern rose over whether we would see restraint out of the military and from the Secretary of Defense in particular when it comes to Trump's foreign policy. And under Shanahan, we have seen more of a strong leaning toward the hawks in the White House. And as a result, you are also seeing a major escalation in major foreign policy fronts, most notably Iran.
In the Trump administration, have you observed that the Secretary of Defense has a lot of power, or is the job totally subservient to President Trump at this point?
If you look at the evolution of the Trump White House, you can see a clear pattern where anyone who is going to openly challenge the president's policies is likely to be sidelined. And so overall, I think with the Secretary of Defense position, you know, when it comes to its ability to influence policy in a way that could act as a restraint and challenge the president. That influence has narrowed. And of course, with the National Security Advisor John Bolton in place, the Secretary of Defense has also weakened relative to that position, but still plays an important role, especially when we're talking about potential military action in the case of Iran, which is a scenario that Trump does not want, even if some of the hawks in his White House, like Bolton, may advocate for at least punitive strikes.
Reva Gujon is with the global intelligence firm Stratfor. Thanks, Reva.
Thank you.
As President Trump launches his 2020 re-election bid tonight, he's also putting a spotlight on immigration again with a threat. Starting next week, the president tweeted, his administration will start deporting millions of undocumented immigrants. So what exactly is Trump talking about? For a reality check, we turn to Mozaffer Chishti. He directs the Migration Policy Institute in New York.
When he talks about millions, I think he obviously tries to refer to all the 10.5 million unauthorized people we have in this country. We know we don't have the political will, we don't have the moral will, we certainly don't have the resources to round up 10.5 million people and deport them. I mean, that's laughable in any administration, including his own. There's been some reporting that he is targeting people who have final orders of removal and have not left. And that number is pretty close to like 960,000 people, pretty close to a million. Even to round that group of people is obviously an impossible task.
Well, you've actually done a lot of work on what it takes to activate mass deportations like the one Trump is threatening to. And even if it's to the smaller group that you just mentioned, is it even realistic? I mean, how do you do it?
No, it really is not for that number of people. It clearly is not realistic given the resources of the Department of Homeland Security for this task. I mean, just to give you a comparative figure, last year, for the entire year, the government removed about 95,000 people from the entire country. Now, to say that you can go up from 95,000 to pretty close to a million, I mean, that would require a massive army. And that would require Congress to appropriate funds, and Congress, and certainly this Congress, is in no mood to do that.
Have there ever been mass deportations ever in U.S. history?
We haven't done this level of mass deportations ever. We rounded up people during the 1940s in the recession, in the Great Depression time, and some in the 60s. But they were in thousands, and they were done in a much more orderly way, because even in a bad situation, people knew where they were. They were working for one particular employer in one particular city, and easy to round them up. That's not the situation for 10.5 million people. They're spread all across the country. They're in our communities. They're living in households with their U.S. citizen kids. So it'll be obviously impossible to do it.
Mozaffer Chishti with the Migration Policy Institute in New York. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
The root causes of Central American migration to the U.S. are hard to solve. That story from Guatemala is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Guatemala is one of the countries in Central America feeling the pressure from Washington, pressure to stop its people from migrating north to the United States. Last week, Guatemalan voters went to the polls to pick a new president. Now the two top vote-getters get to face each other in a runoff election in August. Whoever wins faces a nearly impossible task, complying with American demands on immigration. That's because, as Emily Green reports, migration has become a key source of income for many families in parts of Guatemala.
Fernando Gonzalez Hernandez watches as his nephew saw wood. They're building a cabinet for his new home here in Comunidad Agraria Emmanuel. It's a rural town in western Guatemala. Gonzalez also helps by straightening out old nails with a hammer so they can be reused. The new home is a work in progress, thanks to one person.
Federico Gonzalez Morales.
Gonzalez says his son's name with pride. He works construction in Indiana and sends home remittances, or cash, every month. It's money that's helping build this home, which is bare bones but comfortable. There's a big living room, small kitchen, two bedrooms, a concrete floor. The roof is mostly tin shingles roped together. But Gonzalez says it's better than before. He says it was embarrassing because when it rained, the wind blew off parts of the roof. They had to run and fetch it. So far, the new house has cost around $6,500, way beyond what the family here could save up. Gonzalez is a coffee farmer. He says he makes around $4.50 a day, which isn't enough to pay for basic expenses. It's a situation a lot of families face here, especially since coffee prices have crashed in recent years.
Family remittances to Guatemala were not that important until about 15 years ago.
Manuel Orozco is an expert on migration and remittances. He says today, around 1 in 4 Guatemalan families receive remittances, and those remittances account for roughly 50% of their income. He says one of the first things migrants do with the money is invest in a new home or fix up their old one.
The main reason they do that is because it's a safe, reliable, and attractive way to build assets in your homeland.
Also, buying or building a home in Guatemala is nearly impossible for poor people, Orozco says.
They don't have access to the financial system. There is very little access to mortgages because interest rates are very high.
Exorbitantly high, in fact, hovering around 13%. Here in Comunidad Agraria Emanuel, houses are going up every month with money from remittances. But the trade-off is an exodus of people. Gonzalez's youngest son just left for the U.S. for work, leaving behind his wife and kids. But Gonzalez says his son didn't make it. U.S. border officials called him. He's not sure if his son will be deported. Even if he is, there's a good chance he'll try his luck again. Single adults generally pay smugglers about $10,000 to cross the U.S. border without detection. They usually get 3 shots at it, which means they keep trying, with earning money to send back home a big motivation.
Es por necesidad, por hacer algo, pues, por la familia.
It's for necessity, Gonzalez says, to do something. It's for the family. Claudia Samayoa is a human rights worker in Guatemala. She says Guatemala as a whole has come to financially rely on remittances. They total around $9.3 billion, or 12% of the country's GDP, sent in increments of about $300 per month.
Our main exportation is people.
That, she says, has a negative impact on families. Guatemalans who go to the U.S. often leave behind all or some of their children to be raised by one parent or their grandparents.
There are some studies saying that the possibility of co-opting children for gangs is exactly because the family structure has been lost.
Still, the lure and economic needs driving migration are propelling more people to leave. Mayra Santizo is frying up beef outside her small home here in Comunidad Agraria Emanuel. Both her son and daughter recently migrated to the U.S. We're poor, she says. We can't give my daughter what she wants, for herself or her child. And they'll help us out, send us money. But, she adds, I didn't want them to go. They're leaving us here, alone. For The World, Emily Green, Comunidad Agraria Emanuel, Guatemala.
Okay, a quick reality check now on a recent headline. Archaeologists in Austria find a 3,000-year-old bagel. Yes, a team of archaeologists in Austria did find some interesting bits of ancient dough during a dig. 3 pieces of dough shaped like rings. But bagels? Not exactly. The petrified round bits were slightly smaller and rock hard.
Actually, the original condition could be described as, well, crunchy.
Andreas Heiss is a fellow at the Austrian Archaeological Institute. He led the team that found the dough rings in a pit next to a Bronze Age fort.
These rings look a little bit miserable because they were charred entirely in a fire about 3,000 years ago and spent about 3,000 years in this condition in the soil.
An analysis of the dough revealed that it was made from barley and wheat, so it was definitely edible. But Heiss isn't sure the rings were meant for eating.
The trouble about these rings is that they were found in, let's say, a very bizarre accumulation of materials. So parts of a burnt down house, like a grinding stone, a weird lengthwise split cup, plus a few rings made of clay, and these rings made of dough. So that gave us the problem how to interpret this context. And we do think there might be something more to these rings than just eating.
So perhaps some sort of ceremonial dough? Maybe, but probably not breakfast.
I'm sorry to say that these rings definitely were not the remnants of ancient bagels, because if you think of how to make a bagel, this involves like creating a dough, let it leaven, then you boil the dough, and then you bake it. And actually, we have no evidence for any leavening, for any boiling. And maybe these objects were not even baked before they charred, but maybe they were just air-dried, as it seems from their microstructure.
Archaeologist Andreas Heiss there, punching a hole in the headline, Archaeologist Finds Ancient Bagel. I'm Carol Hills. Egypt's Mohamed Morsi acted like a man of the people.
He wasn't overly cosmopolitan. He certainly wasn't elitist. I'm sure he preferred tea to cappuccino or lattes or anything like that.
But for some, his short presidency marked the end of the Arab Spring in Egypt. Still ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Egypt's former president, Mohamed Morsi, was buried today, but not in his hometown, as Morsi's family wanted. Egyptian authorities did not allow that. Instead, the former leader was put to rest at a cemetery in the capital, Cairo. Morsi was Egypt's first democratically elected president, at first a symbol of the Arab Spring. But he was ousted in a military coup in 2013 and spent the rest of his life in jail and on trial. He died yesterday after collapsing in a courtroom in Cairo. Today, the United Nations is calling for an investigation into his death. It says there are concerns about the conditions under which Morsi was detained. The World's Shirin Jafari looks back at Morsi's life and his legacy.
When Egyptians poured into the streets of Cairo back in 2011, Hinda Nafi was excited.
I was hoping first for a personal freedom. I wanted to be free. I wanted my family to accept me who I am.
Nafi grew up in a conservative family in a village in the Nile Delta. She says her family was strict. Her parents didn't want her to go to school or to make any decisions for herself.
So when I participated in the revolution, it was the first time that I feel like I did something that I really wanted.
There were thousands of people like Nafi in the demonstrations that rocked Egypt during the Arab Spring. Young, passionate men and women who were fed up with the old system. Within weeks, they brought down Hosni Mubarak, the dictator who ruled Egypt for 29 years. After that, it was time to vote. Samer Shahata is a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
After there were democratic elections, Mr. Morsi emerged victorious as Egypt's first and only ever last democratically elected president.
This is Cairo's Tahrir Square, moments after the announcement that Mohamed Morsi was elected. Shahata says in many ways Morsi was an accidental president. Initially, his Islamist political party, the Muslim Brotherhood, didn't want to put forward a candidate at all.
But then when it got close to the elections and they saw other people putting their hats in the race, as it were, including former Mubarak elements and leaders, they decided they had no choice but to run a candidate.
Their choice was a man called Khairat Shatter, an engineer and a businessman. But Shatter was disqualified.
And then Morsi was put forward, and in fact, his nickname was at the time the spare tire candidate, because he was really not on anyone's agenda.
The spare tire candidate found himself running a country that was experimenting with democracy for the first time. There were aspects of his character that people liked, says Shahata, who met Morsi a few times.
He really was a man of the people in one sense. He wasn't overly cosmopolitan. He certainly wasn't elitist. You know, I'm sure he preferred tea to cappuccino or lattes or anything like that.
But for Handan Nafi, the protester, Morsi never delivered on what Egyptians like her wanted. She'd hoped he would support protesters who'd been arrested, imprisoned, and tortured. She was one of them. Morsi ignored the human rights abuses, she says.
He didn't try to unite people, and he committed a lot of, his regime committed a lot of violations.
Morsi went on to make other controversial decisions, says Michel Dunn with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. 6 months into his presidency, Morsi came out with a plan for a new constitution.
Very much over the objections of most of the non-Islamist political figures in the country.
It was seen as a power grab by him and the Muslim Brotherhood.
A dramatic showdown between Egypt's military and the ousted president. Once again, millions of citizens have taken to the streets in Cairo.
On July 3, 2013, only a year after Morsi became president, he was deposed in a military coup. Morsi spent the next 6 years in prison, mostly in solitary confinement.
In his 6 years of imprisonment, he had exactly 3 family visits that lasted half an hour each.
Sarah Lee Whitson is with Human Rights Watch. She says Morsi was suffering from diabetes and other health problems.
When he appeared before judges, he repeatedly asked for medical treatment, medical care, to see a specialized medical clinic.
Human Rights Watch and others raised alarms when it became clear that Morsi wasn't getting the medical attention he needed. The Egyptian government denies that. But yesterday, exactly 7 years to the day he was elected president, Mohamed Morsi collapsed in a courtroom in Cairo. He died on the way to the hospital. Michel Dunn of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says Morsi's death is tragic, but she thinks there's a bigger story here.
We're seeing hundreds of deaths inside Egyptian prisons every year, some of them from actual abuse, mistreatment, torture, and others from bad health conditions or denial of treatment.
President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has ruled Egypt with an iron fist since the military coup 6 years ago. So have we seen the end of Egypt's experiment with democracy? Samer Shahada of the University of Oklahoma doesn't think so.
It's not Egypt's last or only chance at democracy, but it was an excellent opportunity for democracy.
Problem is, it might be some time before another opportunity like this arises. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Mohamed Morsi and the Egyptian Revolution are part of the plot of a musical, believe it or not. It's called We Live in Cairo, and it's in its final week at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from our studios here in Boston. Not an easy task, taking a major historical event like Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring, putting it to music, and keeping it accurate. The World's Sarah Birnbaum talked to the writers about challenges they faced.
We Live in Cairo starts with this feeling of hope. All the characters line up at the front of the stage and teach the audience lyrics to a protest anthem that'll come back later on in the show.
Everybody. I was one person who had an idea.
Okay, it's a little kumbaya, a little summer camp, but it's also sweet, right? I mean, the idea that one individual can make a difference.
I died and then I traveled on. I saw the riots in Helwan.
Spoiler alert, that hope is going to come crashing down at the end of the play, but I'll let you bask in the youthful optimism for a second.
Go to the square, go to the square, you'll know the words when you are there.
We Live in Cairo follows a group of friends, their coming of age, and their budding political consciousness in the months before the Arab Spring. The kids are Muslim and Christian, gay, straight, rich, poor, secular, religious. But their anger at Hosni Mubarak, who was the longtime ruler of Egypt, brings them together. And that anger eventually leads them to Tahrir Square. I would say the play is like Rent with an Egyptian flavor. The writers, Daniel and Patrick Lazour, are Arab-American. Their brothers in their mid-20s, and I asked them if they ever feel weird or insecure about telling the story because they're not Egyptian.
Definitely. You constantly. Right now. No. And I think that's why with every draft, with every new song, we're always checking it with people who really, really know this event personally.
The Lazour said that they're really anal about accuracy and getting the facts right.
It's been our highest priority because you're going to have audience members who say, I know what this is, and I remember this. I was there. It's not a Les Mis. It's something that people are going through now.
Okay, so, like, how would you compare your need to be accurate with, say, Lin-Manuel Miranda's need to be accurate in a show like Hamilton, you know, which is a hip-hop musical about the Founding Fathers?
For Hamilton, it's a sort of all of our history in a way, and on some level we know it, so being more creative about ways to tell that story and subvert it is welcome. And I think here, there's just such an enormous responsibility to say audiences coming in might not be aware of this at all. So we need to really be conscious of what we're sharing with them, especially when, you know, this contributes to what they know about the Arab world.
Talk about pressure. So they went the extra mile. They took an early draft of the script to Professor Tariq Masood, an expert in Egyptian politics at Harvard and lover of musicals. Cool. So when you first saw the script, what was that script like?
What struck me most was that it was mainly a musical about the success of 2011. Most of it was these young people and what motivated them and how they transformed from, in some cases, quite apathetic and apolitical people into the kinds of people who would go into the streets, camp out in a major square in Cairo for 18 days demanding the fall of the regime, and has this triumphant note. It then has an epilogue. It recognizes that today Egypt is not the place that those revolutionaries tried to create, that today Egypt is governed by a regime that is authoritarian, that does not reflect what those people wanted. But there wasn't a lot about what happened between the successful revolution and the grim reality of the present day.
So Masood and the brothers went back and forth over the next several months, and they did a bunch of rewrites and had a ton of conversations.
So I think what we realized was that we would be doing a disservice to this story if we didn't take into account these momentous events after 2011, when the Muslim Brotherhood came into power, and then in 2013 when Sisi came into power, who is currently the president.
So it sounds like you're saying that it would be inauthentic to end it with, hey, this revolution was successful, when we're in the Sisi regime.
Yes. Well, and I think in terms of what you're getting at in terms of authenticity and inauthenticity, for us as Westerners, you know, seeing these news stories in 2011, that was the quote-unquote authentic story of the revolution to us. So we thought, okay, this will make a great musical. This has a great ending, has a hopeful, you know, sort of triumphant end. But as we started going deeper and deeper, I think we started realizing how complicated it all is.
The Lazors added a second act. And remember how I told you earlier that all that feel-good, change starts with one person stuff was going to come, like, crashing down on you by the end of the play? That's Act Two in a nutshell.
What? I wish we could go back. It was better under Mubarak. I'm leaving.
You just go home.
The friends start to argue. They can't agree on who to vote for, if they should accept the results of the free and fair elections, or if they should go back and protest again. To quote Hamilton, winning was easy, young man, governing's harder.
I don't recognize me. Is what my mother says true?
By the end, everyone's isolated and alone. Some friends are in jail, some are dead, and some, God forbid, move to New York. And you have this tragic reprise of the song, Just One Person. So musical theater, right? I asked Professor Masood how the Lazors measure up at the end of the day when it comes to accuracy, and he said pretty good, but not perfect.
Sometimes they have to take artistic license with things. Sometimes certain events that an Egyptian politics geek like myself might think are deeply important don't get reflected in the... I have argued that I wish they would do some kind of musical number on the Muslim Brotherhood.
It's going to be an instant hit.
I have ideas.
Call me.
Yeah, we'll talk. Yeah.
So I'm at a different place now than I was when I started thinking about this whole thing. Not with the Muslim Brotherhood toe tapper, because that's just like a really bad idea, but with the idea of accuracy. So at first, I wanted to figure out, you know, how accurate is this play about Egypt? But then I started to realize that we're still trying to figure out what happened in Egypt. You know, there is no truth. There is no consensus. And if this play becomes even half as popular as Hamilton or Rent, it could have a considerable influence on the way people think about what happened during the Arab Spring and then why it went so wrong. I'll let Professor Massoud have the last word.
My view of this is that they do have a responsibility to accurately reflect what happened in Egypt, but their primary responsibility is actually to the work of art itself and to the broader transcendent message that they're trying to deliver.
And that message is about the simultaneous power and powerlessness of the individual, that sometimes one person can start a revolution, but other times one person's just one person.
We are blood, you and I.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We are children of the Nile. While they laughed and made their plans, we made our own. We made our own.
Sign your name here for Tamarud. Yoskut, Yoskut, Mohammed Morsi. Tamarud, has anyone not yet signed?
The revolution is not over until the demands of the people are met.
Here's the second verse. We made a stage in Tahrir. Marched over bridges across the Nile. When they left us in the cold, we made a home. We made a home. Hey la, 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 hey la.
Tensions have been escalating for weeks between the U.S. and Iran. We heard about that in detail earlier on the show. Right now, let's focus on one major part of those tensions, Tehran's recent announcement that by the end of next week, it will have stockpiled more enriched uranium than it's allowed to under the 2015 nuclear deal. A spokesman for the country's Atomic Energy Agency speaking there, announcing that Iran has quadrupled production of the enriched material, which of course is used to make reactor fuel and potentially could be used to make nuclear weapons. Lacey Healy is a longtime nuclear proliferation expert and host of the PRX podcast Things That Go Boom, whose current season is all about the Iran nuclear deal. Lacey, what do you make of this announcement from Tehran?
This announcement from Tehran is, first of all, it's very concerning. But it's also not unexpected. When Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, a timeline had been set where ultimately, eventually, Iran was going to respond. And I think this is their response.
Behrouz Kamelvandi, the spokesman for the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization we heard from a moment ago, he also spoke about increasing the percentage of enrichment above 3.67%. And it only taking a couple of days to do that. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, so just a very quick explainer on sort of building a nuclear weapon. In order to build a nuclear weapon, you have to enrich uranium at 3.6%. That's about enough to power an energy reactor, for example. Eventually, Iran is talking about increasing up to 20% enrichment, which this is where they were before the Iran nuclear deal. And the reason why we're concerned about 20% is there aren't a lot of uses for 20% enriched uranium. Iran's stated use for that uranium is they have a medical research reactor. So it's essentially it's medical isotopes. But the problem is that once you're at 20%, it's much easier to get to 90%, which is the amount of enriched uranium you need to build a nuclear weapon. And so essentially the deal is going from 0 to 20 takes much more time than going from 20 to 90.
Yeah, it all seems kind of nutty because it's not like if Iran keeps up with aggressive actions like enriching more uranium, it's not as if the U.S. is going to say, oh, okay, we'll relieve you of sanctions. It just seems like a weird game to play.
Yeah, so, you know, it is a weird game to play, but what's funny is both sides have gone exactly back to where they were before the Iran nuclear deal. We're in this place where actually both sides probably want a new nuclear deal, but they're not willing or able to get there in the place where we are right now diplomatically.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is not backing away from sanctions. How are they affecting daily life in Iran?
Yeah, sanctions are really impacting daily life in Iran. And this is why we see Iran getting to the point where they're willing to take these kinds of actions. Iran's economy is really feeling the pain, and so are its people. Their currency, the rial, has lost about 60% of its value against the dollar since Trump reinstated sanctions. And inflation is galloping. The official inflation rate is more than 40%. But some foods are in hyperinflation territory. It is dizzying 90%. And that's causing some Iranians to take drastic action, as we've been finding out in this latest installment of Things That Go Boom. In Iran, there's this thing called Divar.
It's an Iranian version of Craigslist.
It's kind of like Craigslist. Recently, we called up Fatima Jamalpour at her home.
I'm a reporter based in Tehran.
And she said that she's noticed that people have started posting all kinds of things for sale on Divar, even their pets.
For example, one of those said, I bought my purebred Pomeranian dog, 5 million tamen.
That's about $1,500.
But now I'm selling him for 4 million tamen as I'm going to immigrate.
A purebred Pomeranian. That's so funny. Oh, and sad.
When Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, he also reimposed tough sanctions beginning in August of 2018, sending Iran's economy into a tailspin. And as a result, some folks are cutting and running.
Another one that really surprised me was about selling her unused cosmetics to get money for immigration.
So Fatima's been keeping an eye on the property listings.
And then I saw this ad. Two stories, unused, close to the metro, selling due to immigration.
So two stories close to the metro, that sounds like a really fabulous apartment, right?
It's not an apartment he's selling, it's his grave.
Wow. Huh.
So Fatima gave this guy a call, and he was super nice. He agreed to talk to her as long as we didn't use his name.
People are nervous about talking to reporters, especially international media.
And they decided to meet at the cemetery, the one near the metro.
So we met this cemetery. It's a really big one. People over there reciting prayers from Quran. And that's actually near to Ayatollah Khomeini's grave.
Ayatollah Khomeini is the one from the 1979 revolution, the country's former supreme leader.
And he kind of made a joke, like, you can say hello to Ayatollah Khomeini on your way, and then you turn left down here.
Well, it's very convenient.
He told me you used to have a car dealership. You know, the U.S. sanction affected car manufacturers in Iran a lot because they can't import the car parts. And he had to sell his dealership, and now he wants to join his family members who lives overseas in Canada.
So does that mean, because of the sanctions, that he's not actually getting the cars to be able to sell them? It's a supply issue?
Yeah.
I asked Fatima if she had a sense of how he felt about selling his grave.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot.
He said his wife doesn't want him to sell.
But he told her, I don't believe in anything at all anymore. Although it's an Iranian soil, it's just a grave.
Shocking as his story may be, the gentleman Fatima spoke to isn't alone. He told her about a guy who was trying to sell a whole family plot to
24 graves in all.
And he said, I haven't been able to sell this single grave, let alone 24 graves.
Because after so many years of economic pain, some Iranians are just done.
I think if you sell your house, that's one thing. You are saying goodbye. But if you sell your grave, you're basically saying goodbye for eternity.
Iranian journalist Fatma Jamalpour speaking with Lacey Healy, host of the PRX podcast, Things That Go Boom. Check it out for more stories of Iranians grappling with life under sanctions. You can find Things That Go Boom wherever you get your podcasts. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.